Well, good morning. It's good to be here. Fascinating exercise in preparing this of trying to get a handle on Fuller and his reception among Southern Baptists. Baptists in general, we're going to talk about Baptists in general, but a lot of it is Southern Baptist, and for a lot of good reasons there. But the basic storyline is that Fuller's influence displaced Gill's influence. But it's more complicated than that for a lot of reasons. And so I want us to explore a little bit the contours of the reception of both John Gill and Andrew Fuller, and then how Southern Baptists appropriated that, how that played out. And as we do so, we're going to get a feel for how Baptist theology was changing. The appropriation of these two thinkers reflects also the transformation of the theology of Baptists in the United States, especially in the South. Until about 1830, John Gill was the most influential theologian among Baptists, or perhaps I should say the most influential Baptist theologian. You could make an argument for Calvin being more influential. You could make an argument, at least after around 1800, for even Timothy Dwight. I don't think that was a little harder to pull off, but Dwight did have a lot of influence, and largely because he had an accessible systematic theology that was different than Gill. But around 1830, John Gill, the most influential Baptist theologian among Baptists in America. When William B. Johnson was 10 years old, and many of you know that name, William B. Johnson became the first president of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1845. William B. Johnson played an instrumental role in the early missionary organizations, the formation of the first missionary societies and the first state Baptist conventions, which were for the support of foreign missions. William B. Johnson, a very influential figure in Southern Baptist life. Well, William B. Johnson was 10 years old. He went to his pastor, William Staunton, in Georgetown, South Carolina, and he asked him a question about the interpretation of the Scriptures. I love it when the 10-year-olds come in to seek your advice on Scripture. Well, Staunton said, "My boy, I will bring you some writings that you may see what wise and good men have said upon it." And as Johnson related, repairing to his study, he brought out Gill and some others. And he read their views, and then he gave his own. So it wasn't just Gill that he brought out, but Gill's the only one that Johnson tells by name. Gill's the one that stands out in his mind. When Baptists in New England needed help, theological help, help in repelling the arguments of their Puritan counterparts who were blasting them with their Harvard and some of them Cambridge educations on their doctrine of baptism, the Baptists in New England turned to Gill and asked for help. And Gill wrote a defense of believers' baptism, or more precisely, an attack on infant baptism, and published in 1766, Infant Baptism, a Part and Pillar of Popery. And it wasn't just the colonial Baptists in Massachusetts who found that work helpful. Baptists continued to find Gill's work on baptism helpful in 1851, republishing it, slightly revised. But the American Baptist Publication Society in Philadelphia republished Gill's Infant Baptism, Part and Pillar of Popery in 1851. In 1809, the Charleston Baptist Association passed a resolution supporting the publication of an American edition of Gill's commentaries. And this actually resulted in a broad effort in wide subscription among the churches to republish Gill's commentaries. The association asked its members to encourage, by their subscriptions, the laudable design of Mr. Woodward in Philadelphia of reprinting Dr. Gill's truly valuable exposition of the Bible, in that each church in particular provide itself with a copy to be kept for the use of its minister and his successors. And so what they were urging is every church to buy a copy of Gill's commentaries, so that their pastor and his successors would always have Gill there available for consultation. 2 years later, the Charleston Association agreed to recommend to our churches Dr. Stalton's abridgment of Dr. Gill's Body of Divinity. John Gill, his influence came down primarily through the churches over the generations through his commentaries and his Body of Dogmatic Divinity and Practical Divinity, his full systematic theology, both in terms of theology proper and in terms of ecclesiology. So you have the Charleston Association, the most influential association in Southern Baptist life for several generations, commending the republication of Gill, and clearly for the purpose of influencing the pastors. Southern Baptists continue to find value in Gill's writings long after Andrew Fuller's influence eclipsed Gill's influence. Tilman Gaines, for example, praised Gill in high terms in 1870. Tilman Gaines was the editor of the South Carolina Baptist newspaper. Here's what Gaines said. It's rather striking language, in fact. When Robert Hall said that Dr. Gill's commentary was a continent of mud, this is a quote that I expect Dr. Weaver will come into us in some measure. When Robert Hall said that Dr. Gill's commentary was a continent of mud, he showed that his great judgment was not exempt from bias and prejudice. One of the other newspapers, and still quoting Gaines, one of the other newspapers had occasion recently to publish Hall's definition, and through a mistake, the printer put it thus, a continent of mind, rather than a continent of mud. Printer's mistake. Gaines said, "We think the printer's mistake came nearer expressing the true merit of Gill's commentaries than did Robert Hall's expression." So in 1870, I don't expect to find many people praising Gill anymore, even Southern Baptists, even the most conservative. The continent of mud quote is one that I've heard repeated over and over. And here in 1870 is a leading Southern Baptist saying that really Gill's commentary is a continent of mind, not of mud. Now, Southern Baptists had their reservations and criticisms of Gill even when they recognized his value. And so John Broadus, when he taught his classes in New Testament, he would give them an outline of commentaries. Here are all the commentaries. Here's what's good about them. Here's what's bad about them. Here's the ones you should look to primarily. And we have some of the notebooks of the students who sat in those lectures, and so we have pretty thoroughly what Broadus said about all these commentaries. Well, Broadus really wasn't all that favorable on any of the commentaries. His comments are more critical than positive, but he used to have something. He'll find something positive to say about all of them. But with regard to Gill, here's what Broadus said: Gill is dammed up, and that's D-A-M-M-E-D. So Gill is dammed up with heaps of rabbinical learning. Right, and if you've used Gill's commentaries very much, you recognize the accuracy of this. He's always quoting the rabbis, and if you're looking for that, it's incredibly helpful. If you're not looking for that, it can get in your way, and that's Broadus' point. So it's dammed up with heaps of rabbinical learning, and it is muddy with vague interpretation and utterly given over to spiritualizing. But it is thoroughly sound in doctrine and warm in devout feeling. So even when Southern Baptists appreciated Gill, they were not afraid to criticize him. Now, as I said, the storyline here is that the influence of Andrew Fuller eclipses that of Gill around 1830, around the time of the publication of Fuller's works, his collected works. But Fuller's influence was felt even before that. For example, in the North, you've got a couple examples before that. In 1818, the New Hampshire, one of the leading churches in New Hampshire was the Newport Baptist Church, and its pastor was both the pastor of this largest church in the entire association, and he was the principal, the headmaster, the president of a little seminary that they had there. It never got very large, but the pastor's name was Elijah Hutchison. And in 1818, he wrote a circular letter for the association in which he and the association called upon the authority of the venerable Dr. Fuller to enforce the practical bearings of the doctrines of depravity and predestination. So the circular letter actually claimed to be on the doctrine of Christ, but it spent most of its time on soteriology, focusing on soteriology, but depravity and predestination as implications of those, or foundations of those. Fuller, he called upon to show how important these doctrines are to our Christian lives, quoted Fuller at length. The editor of Boston's Christian Watchman, James Loring, in 1831, concluded an article defending particular redemption with several extended passages from Andrew Fuller's arguments for that doctrine, quoted Fuller at great length. In the South, Richard Furman, as he was dying in 1825, had an illness that caused him considerable pain and difficulty. But as he was dying, he looked to the Scriptures to provide him with comfort, but he also looked to some Christian literature and Andrew Fuller's essays and John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress were the two that he took special pleasure in. In 1833, Jesse Mercer, who disagreed with Fuller, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but Jesse Mercer referred to Fuller as the excellent Fuller. Joseph Baker in 1848 commended Fuller and Mercer equally. Joseph Baker was one of the leading pastors and longtime editor of the Georgia Baptist newspaper, the Christian Index. Joseph Baker said this. He said, every Baptist minister in Georgia who does not have should have the works of Andrew Fuller. And the memoirs of Jesse Mercer should be in the hands of every minister. So Fuller and Mercer, they agree on most things, but they have their disagreement concerning the atonement. Young pastor William D. Thomas in the 1860s wrote a letter to John Broadus complaining that he doesn't have any education. Here he is, pastor of a church. He's got to prepare these sermons, but he doesn't have any theological education, and he feels his weakness and his inadequacy to the task. And I think he's trying to get encouragement to sacrifice to come to the seminary. But he's writing Broadus complaining about this. He says, I'm trying as best I can by consulting Fuller's works and Dwight's theology, but I don't much like the latter. So that leaves him with Fuller's works. But, you know, the thing about Dwight is Dwight has a systematic theology. The lectures he gave at Yale College in the 1790s, republished as a systematic theology. Fuller didn't write a systematic theology. Fuller was an occasionalist, a controversialist, a polemicist, a counselor to the needs of the churches. James B. Boyce, the founding president of Southern Seminary, called Fuller a man of the clearest perceptions and of remarkable power of precise statement. And in the 1870s, possibly as early as the 1860s, students here at Southern Seminary founded an Andrew Fuller Society. Dr. Haken, did you know this? That the students did found that early? And primarily an intellectual society, a society to encourage study Christian literature and to encourage debating and the development of intellectual and speaking skills. Now, most Baptists interpreted Fuller and Gill. Wandering a little bit there, Steve. I'm trying to stay close here. He asked me if I wanted the lavalier mic because if I needed to pace the platform, I told him I tried to be good. Most Baptists interpreted Fuller and Gill as in basic agreement, but they recognized that Fuller displaced Gill in influence. And you see this cited in a number of different places, especially when in the latter part of the 19th century you have older pastors reflecting on all the changes that have taken place. And they'll often say, well, back 50 years ago or 75 years ago, all the pastors had Gill and maybe Dwight, but in recent, then a generation later, they had Fuller. And depending on when they're writing, now they have something else. But we'll come back to that later. Most Baptists interpreted Fuller and Gill as being in basic agreement, but they recognized that Fuller displaced Gill in influence. And so the editors of Charleston's Southern Baptist newspaper in 1848 observed This is 1848. There has unquestionably been a great change that has come over the spirit of Calvinism. It is now held in a greatly modified and softened form. Now, I'm not saying they're exactly right in their interpretation. They've got an agenda. These particular editors do have an agenda that they're pressing. But their basic observation, though I disagree with it in part, their basic observation is valid. So Calvinism is now held in a greatly modified and softened form. The followers of Gill and Crisp are few and rapidly diminishing. That's the point I disagree with, throwing Gill and Crisp together. Crisp was an antinomian, and Steve can correct me if he disagrees with that, but Crisp was an antinomian. John Gill was not, not even close. I feel like I got to qualify that. He did provide some aid and comfort to some antinomians by some of the things he said. I think it's important to recognize that as well. But Gill was certainly not an antinomian. So the followers of Gill and Crisp are few and rapidly diminishing, while the disciples of Andrew Fuller are becoming much more numerous. By 1848, that's largely a done deal for Baptist preachers in the South. The same Tillman Gaines that I mentioned praising Gill earlier, he said this about Fuller and Gill in 1871. Fuller believed the Calvinistic theory as firmly as Gill did, and God gave Fuller the ability to give to every man his portion of divine truth in due season. Fuller stirred all England on the importance of sounding out the gospel to the ends of the earth. Under his influence, Baptists of England formed a missionary society. Gill had dug up the pure metal of divine truth. Fuller proved that it was pure and worthy of all acceptation. And borrowing part of one of Fuller's titles. Now, the significance of the disagreement between Gill and Fuller focused on the atonement, and in particular, how the atonement was to be described, in what sense the atonement was general, and what sense it was particular. Jesse Mercer in 1833 thought that Fuller's discussion of the atonement ended up in pretty much the same place as Gill, but Mercer disagreed with how Fuller got there. Mercer described himself as being rather of the old school than of the new. He said, "I incline to the old-fashioned doctrine of free grace as preached among the Baptists near half a century ago." He said, "I do not mean to quibble or to criticize on mere modes of expression or shades of difference where the truth is not compromised. However, I do not fully receive all of Mr. Fuller's views on the methods of divine mercy. Yet I am satisfied that his scheme, Fuller's scheme, as now generally preached, when kept within its own bounds, leads to and finally secures the same great and glorious results as those of the most approved and Calvinistic writers of this age." So it's a praise of Gill, but a praise of Fuller. He had praised Fuller in the paper before, and he got some criticism for that. He got some pushback. So now he's explaining exactly the terms in which he supports Fuller. He said in another passage, he said, "I am inclined to the doctrine of such men as Gill, Owen, Brown, Toplady, Hervey, that the atonement is special both in its provisions and applications. But the men and the doctrine who teach that the atonement is general in its provisions, but special in its application, form the new school. To this representation, though taught by the excellent Fuller, we do not incline." So the difference between Fuller and Gill has to do with precisely how you describe the general and special characteristics of the atonement. John Dagg had a similar evaluation. John Dagg, one of the most influential theologians, ultimately, among Southern Baptists, president of Mercer University. John Dagg had a similar evaluation in 1860. He said, "Dr. Gill differs from Mr. Fuller in the use of the word atonement. In my judgment, Fuller conforms more nearly..." Wait a minute. Let me make sure I get this right. I think I messed that up. I'm trying to modernize their syntax a little bit. They have these long sentences. They get very complicated. I'm trying to chop it up, and I think I chopped that one wrongly. Dr. Gill differs from Mr. Fuller in the use of the word atonement, and in my judgment, so he's praising Gill here, Gill conforms more nearly to the signification of the term in the New Testament. But a different use of a word does not constitute a different system of divinity. These two great men agreed in their views of Christian doctrine far more than many persons appear to suppose. Fuller believed in particular redemption as firmly as Gill. Now, why does Dagg have to emphasize that point in 1860? Because there were many who were claiming Fuller for innovations that Fuller would not have supported. Now, Fuller's partly to blame for this, and it's not moral culpability in my estimation, but he does use some words in some new ways, but he also changes his mind on some things, and particularly on imputation. And it's here that Fuller gets, I was going to start to say first, and really I should say second. First, Fuller gets used in some inappropriate ways with regard to the evaluation of the churches of the new missions movement. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Fuller and Carey forming the particular Baptist Society for the propagation of the gospel among the heathen. What was the name of the first Baptist Society for missions? I'm close, right? It was a big, big, long title for the... Okay. In India and other parts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can't even reduce that to an acronym, right? But Fuller and Carey started that, and this began, this inspired most Baptists to begin organizing local societies in their churches to support this missionary labor, and this resulted in more and more organizations. Well, a minority of Baptists in the United States opposed that. They opposed these missionary organizations. They said the apostles didn't have any missionary societies. They didn't need any. They had a church. Right, you love that little argument there, right? But this was a significant minority. And they claimed that Fuller was an Arminian. Or I don't know if they ever used the word Pelagian, but the language, the definitions they use suggest even Pelagianism at times. But that's related then to the doctrine of imputation as well. So Fuller first gets pulled in some inappropriate ways and some misinterpretations, I believe, regarding missionary organization. But secondly, on imputation, Fuller becomes an important witness to both sides of one of the most disturbing, what's the word? I started saying invigorating. I'm not sure theological debate's always invigorating. To us, it can be because we're interested in that. But one of the more energetic theological debates in Southern Baptist history occurred 1848 to 1850 over the doctrine of imputation. It's not widely known, has not been widely noticed, but you get into the newspapers at the time, and it's there, especially in South Carolina and Georgia. And the reason for this debate is that James Reynolds, who was a professor of theology at Furman, lodged an accusation of heterodoxy against the other professor of theology, Edward Mims, at Furman. Well, about the time he lodged this accusation over a rejection of imputation, he said Mims rejects imputation, the imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity and the imputation of Christ's righteousness to the redeemed. And I think Reynolds is right about that. Reynolds, at about that time, resigned from his position at Furman and took a position at Mercer in Georgia. And Reynolds, students apparently were coming to Reynolds, and it's, maybe some of them were studying at Furman at the time, and said, well, should I come to Mercer? And new students who were thinking about going to do a little theology study, well, should I go to Mercer? They didn't have full seminaries, so you had undergraduate education, and then you would spend a year or two studying theology with a theology professor. That's how it worked in those days. And Reynolds, of course, was saying, well, you know, Mims is not orthodox. You need to come to Mercer, which is Orthodox. Dagg was president at that time. And Furman's unsound. And so it becomes a big, big controversy, especially in South Carolina, in Georgia. Well, there were a number of important leaders in South Carolina, especially, who opposed the doctrine of imputation, who rejected it, who said imputation is not taught in the Bible. William B. Johnson, who I mentioned earlier, first president of the Southern Baptist Convention, rejected imputation. So did Thomas Meredith, who was at that time, I believe, the president of Wake Forest. He was in North Carolina. A number of other important leaders at that time, and they generally appealed to Fuller. They made their biblical arguments, of course. They made their theological arguments, but over and over again, they appealed to Fuller and quoted Fuller against the doctrine of imputation. Johnson himself said that Fuller's views had spread so widely within the last 10 or 15 years that Baptists no longer preach the doctrine of imputation. Now, I think Johnson's wrong about this, though. It's hard to prove, but I think Johnson is misinterpreting what he's hearing. He's definitely misinterpreting Fuller, at least in part. He's privileging part of Fuller against the other. So Johnson said this. So this is 1848. Johnson said, my object, he was asking for the confessions of faith of all the associations in South Carolina. He's writing to a personal friend saying, can you get me all the confessions of all the associations? He said, I know that a couple of them have confessions, but I need all of them. He said, my object is to find out if these associations profess a belief in the doctrine of imputation, the rejection of which is specified against Professor Mims. Johnson was Mims' big defender in public. By imputation, Professor Reynolds means, I suppose, the imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity and the imputation of Christ's righteousness to all believers. I am aware that this doctrine is embodied in the Confession of Faith published by the Charleston and Savannah River Associations. It's also in the Edgefield Association's Abstract of Principles. And, you know, that admission alone should have gone much further with Johnson than it did, because these three associations are the oldest, most respected, and most influential associations in the state. But I have not for many years heard imputation preached. And I am of the opinion that preachers in these associations and in our state generally do not advance this doctrine. Since Andrew Fuller's views have been abroad, I have supposed that his views have met with general approval and were accordingly preached. See, he doesn't even bother to say that Fuller opposed imputation. He assumes that Fuller opposes imputation and that Fuller's views, now having gone abroad, is the reason that he no longer hears imputation being preached. And a little further on, he says, not that Adam's sin is imputed to us. He's giving his own views now. Not that Adam's sin is imputed to us, but that by a divine constitution, by his disobedience, we are made or constituted sinners, and by the obedience of Christ, we are made righteous. That rationale is not explained to us, but the fact is simply stated. William B. Johnson was new divinity. He studied under Jonathan Maxey, one of the clearest new divinity theologians, a Baptist, president of Brown University, then president of the University of South Carolina, which is when William B. Johnson went to study theology with Maxey, when he's president of the University of South Carolina. And it is, I think, without doubt, that it is from Maxey that William B. Johnson learns new divinity. He could have gotten it from Dwight. He could have gotten it from any number of other books. But there you have the direct mentoring, discipling of Johnson by Maxey. For over a year, Johnson would go to, he gives some indication that it's more than just once a week. He's going constantly to Maxey's home and studying theology with him at night. In another letter, going over the same ground, Johnson said this. He said, Reynolds lays much stress on imputation, by which he means, I suppose, the imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity and Christ's righteousness to believers. It is true that this doctrine is contained in the confessions of faith that he mentioned before, but whether in any other in the state, I do not know. But although it is in these associations, I do not remember hearing it advanced in conversation or preached in sermons for many years. Since Fuller's views have been published in the Gospel, Its Own Witness, and in the Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation, I have been of the opinion that the doctrine of imputation has been gradually going out of use, and that the Baptists, at least in this state, were becoming moderate Calvinists, so that there was not any difficulty among brethren. Will you be so kind as to state in your reply what are your views of imputation, writing to another friend? And William B. Johnson quotes in some of his public articles in the newspaper against imputation, he quotes Fuller extensively from Gospel, Its Own Witness, and Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation, first edition. I haven't gone back to check, but I'm assuming he's using the first edition there. Fuller himself felt he had some splaining to do on that, on those statements, and he did explain in his reply to Philanthropus and some of his letters concerning Abraham. Abraham Booth took Fuller to task on imputation, and Fuller defended his views on imputation. I do believe in imputation, Fuller said. However, I do not believe it as a transference of a property. It's not some kind of physical or commercial transference. It is rather a reckoning to the account. Anyway, you can read about that. But Fuller does have some different expressions of imputation, effectively rejecting imputation, but based upon a definition that he came to reject. So as he explained his earlier statements in Gospel, Its Own Witness, he said, I no longer hold that view. I had a misunderstanding of what imputation was. I thought it was a transference. But now I understand that that's not what it is. I affirm imputation. And he quotes then some of the earlier writers on imputation in his agreement with them. Now, some Baptist leaders and preachers had a more pragmatic understanding. And I think it's important just to point this out. Those of us who are here, we tend to appreciate the importance of theology. We tend to recognize that. And that can make us forget sometimes that many of our brothers aren't as excited about theology as we are. And that's all right. But sometimes it causes them to take a rather pragmatic turn when they come to theologians such as John Gill and Fuller. And my favorite, and you know, pragmatist is probably not quite the right word for John Leland. John Leland knew the importance of theology, but he's at the same time he rather demeaned theological writings, and he was in some respects a pragmatist. That is, he tended to evaluate truth in some respects by how useful it was in converting sinners. Okay, so that's all there, but he was a pietist, and pietist is probably a better word for Leland than pragmatist. John Leland, one of the most effective evangelists from the 1780s until early 1800s, 1810 or so, God used him extensively, first in Virginia and then in a couple revivals in Massachusetts. And Leland is known especially for his opposition to established churches. His arguments for religious freedom came at the time that first Virginia and then the federal constitution debated the issue. James Madison being an important co-belligerent. I should say Madison recognizing Leland's importance as a co-belligerent in both Virginia and in the federal debates. And it's hard for us to conceive how difficult this issue was for many American leaders to accept. We take religious freedom as sort of a matter of course. Yeah, obviously, we should have religious freedom. It was not obvious. In fact, it's still not obvious. We still need to make the arguments. But so Leland, influential, respected, but also eccentric. And I think most of his friends recognize that. I should say Leland's also well known now for his mammoth cheese. You guys have heard of the mammoth cheese? The passage that I want to read to you occurs in his expanded diary just after his passage on the cheese. He collected cheese from You know, the presidential election, this is about the presidential election. He gave a present to Thomas Jefferson of 2,000 pound cheese. It was 2,000 pounds, right? I think it was 2,000 pounds. He put it on a wagon, transported it from Massachusetts down to Washington, D.C. to give it as a gift to Thomas Jefferson because the people of his county were Jeffersonians. Right, you know, think of Massachusetts is a stronghold of federalism, but all these dairy farmers out where Leland lived were staunch Jeffersonians, Republicans, they were called at the time. And so, and Leland was one of the chief ringleaders of the Jeffersonians in that area. And so he brings his cheese down, and he's known for this. It's called the Mammoth Cheese, and of course, John Leland was known as the Mammoth Priest in the newspapers. The newspapers are covering this. Right? This is good, sensational news. And so here's his passage, first about the Mammoth Cheese, and then about Fuller and Gill. And I just say, notice that for Leland, it's as much about preaching as it is about honoring Jefferson. By the way, what is Jefferson? What do you do when you're president and you receive a gift like this, right? Or what do you do with that? Well, Jefferson did the only sensible thing. He declared a wine and cheese party for the next day. Invited the public to come and eat this cheese. But Jefferson did one other thing. He got his revenge upon Congress because he called Congress together to listen to John Leland preach. Leland, this country Baptist preacher, and you know all these educated aristocratic, well, okay, not all of them, but some of them, educated and aristocratic members of Congress. In the close of 1801, I traveled southward as far as Washington. Remember, the election is in November of 1800, and the inauguration would have been in March of 1801. So in the close of 1801, I traveled southward as far as Washington. Preaching was not my only object. Preaching was not my only object in this journey. I went as agent to present the great cheese. And he puts this in all capitals. The great cheese to the president. My tour was 4 months, and I preached 74 times. Right, so this may have been the first event evangelism. You got the big cheese out there, and you gather the crowd, and then you preach the gospel. Throw in a little Jeffersonian rhetoric as well. I had the largest congregations attend on this journey of any journey that I ever made. Partly, I suppose, on account of the novelty of my mission. To hear what the mammoth priest had to say. And I hope they were not entirely unedified. At one place in particular, one person got struck, and I think he means by that effectively paralyzed. They couldn't move. One person got struck and was soon brought out, which led to a considerable revival. And he goes immediately on to 1806, 5 years later. At the close of the year 1806, I got amazingly distressed on account of my preaching, fearing that my barrenness in the ministry was owing to improper addresses. He didn't know how to address sinners. This is not a question that we usually struggle over, but this was a live question in the late 18th, and for some, in this case, early 19th century. How do we address sinners? The Methodists were amazingly zealous. He actually says, the Methodists were amazing zealous and successful. And the addresses of their ministers were general and undaunted. I visited them, and I conversed with them. They were all for heaven and assured that they were in the way, but their zeal and confidence appeared to me like the mighty wind and fire in Elijah's vision. Remember? But God was not in the fire. God was not in the wind. And I could not discover that any with whom I conversed had any knowledge of themselves, of the law of God, or of the way of pardon. That's a pretty harsh criticism of the Methodists. But then he goes on to his fellow Baptists. He said, the Gillite mode of addressing sinners seemed a little different than the New Testament mode. Gill's a little hard to pin down on this, I believe. You can make him consistent, but I think if you look at what he actually did, as well as what he said, he's a little hard to pin down. But in theory, at least, Gill said, you address You address the invitation to Christ to sensible sinners, that is, sinners who know that they are sinners, who admit and confess that. And I don't know of any evangelical who would disagree with that, right? Jesus said, I have not come to call the well but the sick, right? I have not come to call the righteous but sinners. It is not the well who need a physician but the sick. But at any rate, the Gilead mode of addressing sinners seemed a little different from the New Testament mode. The Hopkinsian method appeared as if it took all the wisdom of God to devise a way for a honorable pretense to damn men. Now, if you do know Hopkins, you get that. If you don't know Hopkins, you may not. If you don't have time to talk about it. But Hopkins was a new divinity man. William B. Johnson, rejection of imputation, also new divinity. But that's not really the point that he's addressing with Hopkins. Dr. Fuller, to get to our main theme this morning, Dr. Fuller only cast another bundle of straw on the fire. And, of course, Fuller thought that he had made an important contribution to the question of how we are to address sinners. This was an important part of what Fuller was doing in The Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation. But Leland said he cast only another bundle of straw on the fire. So that great question has agitated my mind for more than 30 years. How is a congregation of sinners to be addressed? At the time of which I am now discussing, this question fell with such distress upon my mind that I could hardly contain myself. He almost stopped preaching. But in the midst of my difficulties, I had a meeting at a schoolhouse. And in the time of the service, my soul got into the trade winds. In other words, he felt the power of the Spirit. And without consulting Gill or Wesley or Hopkins or Fuller, and without comparing our translation with the Septuagint Chaldee or the King of Spain Bible, I addressed the students and the young people in a way that I never can, except that God helps me. The Spirit of the Lord fell upon them, and very soon after this, five of them came forward and confessed Christ. This small affair coming at the time that it did afforded me great relief, and I consider it a great mercy. So not everyone found Fuller to be all that helpful. Not everyone thought that the theological writings of either Fuller or Gill were all that helpful. I can't do a paper on Baptists without quoting Leland at some point, so I hope you'll forgive me then. But it does point out that Fuller and Gill were the theologians that every Baptist had to do with. Now, I'm not going to talk about discipline, church discipline, and close communion. These are issues that Fuller dealt with extensively in his writings on an occasional basis, especially. And Baptists did appeal to Fuller to sustain their views of close communion requiring baptism as a prerequisite for participation in the Lord's Supper and for their views of church government generally. But Baptists didn't feel as great a need to quote Fuller on this because these were arguments they used all the time. There are plenty of materials on this. Now, just let me now point out, to bring this to a close, point out the decline of Fuller's influence. Let's just talk about this very briefly. The decline of Fuller's influence. Why did Fuller's influence wane? Well, I believe Fuller's influence waned because Calvinism lost its luster among Baptists. And Calvinism lost its luster when it was displaced by the new theology. The new theology was what we now call liberalism. And liberalism displaced and discredited Calvinism and, of course, displaced and discredited Fuller. Norman Fox, a progressive pastor in New York in the 1880s, gave an overview of the changes in theology among Baptist ministers that had occurred over the past century. This is 1885, and he's speaking to the Third Annual Baptist Conference. It had a couple of different names over the years, but I want to tell you about this conference, but we don't have time. This conference was a deliberate plan of the progressives to introduce liberalism in the churches. And nobody knew it at the time. well, a few of the organizers, this is the closest thing I can get to a real conspiracy in Baptist history, all right, where you got the organizers of a group and movement who have, they know the purpose, but they don't share that purpose with anybody else, and they actually accomplish, amazingly, what they set out to accomplish. At any rate, so Norman Fox drew applause from the audience at this conference when he consigned Gill, Fuller, and Edwards to the moldy trash heap of history. He said, the name New Theology strikes many brethren with terror. New Theology, at this time, is liberalism. Strikes many brethren with terror, for they think it must mean a revolutionary theology. Now, there may be a New Theology, but it's not revolutionary. And then he goes to the past. He says, among Baptists, we speak of Andrew Fuller's theology as a new theology compared to Gill. In other words, there may be a new school of Christian thought which is not revolutionary or directly antagonistic to the former trains of thought. And if so, if it be announced today that there is a new theology, it does not follow that it is in direct conflict with all former models of thought, or that it is a revolutionary theology, or that it is subversive of old doctrines. In other words, this new theology, this liberalism, he's saying, is not revolutionary, it's not subversive of the past, it is in continuity. It's just progress. Don't be worried about it, don't be afraid, it's just progress. Again, so far as there is a new theology, every real thinker holds that theology to a greater or less extent. Everyone holds to this, he says, to a greater or less extent. Some of our brethren glory in holding to the old theology, but I don't know what they mean by it. But I will say this. There is not a man in this house who holds the old theology of 100 years ago. These are all preachers, and some lay leaders, but mostly preachers. There is not a human being in the Baptist denomination today who dares to take his stand on the Philadelphia Confession and preach it boldly. And by the way, he's not saying that there's nobody who believes it, but he is saying there's nobody who will preach it. For personal popularity, a Baptist preacher of today might fare better to preach the Walker Confession of the Universalists than the fair and square confession of the old Baptists. Let the preacher stand up and take the Philadelphia Confession, the damnation of infants implied, if not positively inserted, the old predestinarian Calvinism. Brethren, there is not a man of you who will stand up and preach that fairly and squarely. We talk about Jonathan Edwards' theology, but let a minister plagiarize a sermon. He had better not plagiarize Jonathan Edwards' sermons very extensively. Let him copy Jonathan Edwards' sermons, and his resignation would be speedily handed in. There are changes of thought, and all are swept on with them. Some sit in the back row of the boat looking forward. Some sit in the stern of the boat looking backward. But all are being swept forward together. And then, in square brackets, applause from all the Baptist pastors there. Fuller was swept away as Calvinism was swept away by liberalism. One more quote here along the same lines, but this one less approving. Robert Williamson, an older pastor in Virginia, said the same thing in the 1880s concerning the Virginia Baptist preachers of the past and the present. He said, 50 years ago, Gill's Body of Divinity and Gill's commentaries on the sacred scriptures, Owens and Flavel's works were thought to be indispensable to a preacher's library. So Gill's Divinity, Gill's commentaries, Owen and Flavel, indispensable to a good preacher's library. Among the works of minor importance found upon the shelves of the preacher's bookcase in those times were Doddridge's Rise and Progress of the Soul, Baxter's Saints Rest, Hall's Help to Zion, Strouder's Booth's Reign of Grace, etc. The old Baptist preachers were, as a general thing, rigid Calvinists. They were pretty well up on the 5 points. Under the teachings and influence of Dr. Gill's theological sentiments, the vast majority of our preachers became hyper-Calvinists. Well, that's not quite right, but some of them did. Some of the Calvinists became antinomians. The grace of God was perverted into lasciviousness. All Christian activities were ignored or disapproved. He's talking about primitive Baptists there who opposed missions and other societies. Sending the glad tidings of salvation to the perishing heathen was derided. These men were of the same opinion as the good old John Ryland in his attempted reproof of William Carey. Sit down, young man. When the Lord wants the heathen converted, he can do it without your aid or mine. Such was the tendency of the theological opinion among our Baptist fathers 50 or 60 years ago.
But after a while, Baptist preachers of the Calvinistic creed became enamored with the theology of Andrew Fuller and adopted, for the most part, his peculiar views and became Fullerites instead of Gillites. Fuller was, no doubt, the greatest and soundest theologian of the Baptists of modern times. 30 years ago, no Baptist preacher thought his library complete without the works of Andrew Fuller. So that would have been around 1850. Then also, Dwight's theology and Jonathan Edwards' works were much admired. The works of Dwight have fallen into disuse, and those of Edwards are not as popular as formerly. Jay's works, so practical and full of spirit devotion, were much admired also. In polemical theology, Booth's Pado Baptism and Carson's great work on baptism occupied a conspicuous place. But this is a world of change. You may examine the libraries of our young preachers who have just come from the theological seminaries, and you will find but few of the works named above. In some, it is doubtful whether you will find any of Fuller's works or Carson on baptism. In this age of change, or so-called progress, a new theology bids fair to come into vogue. The works already referred to do not contain this new theology. Mr. Spurgeon, if the papers represent him justly, has just left the Baptist Union on account of the new theology. The Baptist preachers, whose theological tenets are so objectionable to Mr. Spurgeon, certainly did not get their theology from Fuller and Gill. So Norman Fox was praising the abandonment of Gill and Fuller. Robert Williamson of Virginia is regretting the loss of the influence of Fuller and Gill. Are we going to Germany for our theology as well as for literature? The preacher is, to a large extent, what his library makes him. Of course, that works both ways. Preacher makes his library also. The preacher is what his library makes him. How necessary that he exercise profound wisdom in selecting his books as well as in the choice of his studies. Let all his books be subordinated to the book of all books, the inspired word of truth, the Bible. So I'm just going to end it right there with an exhortation. Select your books well. Make sure that those books which edify, those books which themselves reflect the truths of the book of books, have the central place in your library and in your personal study.